So we are getting very close to the end of our study of that period of Israel's history concerning the kings. Now we've been, it's been some years now. I know it's certainly covered through the entire period going back. When we started our study of the books that are divided up into that category that is usually referred to as the Old Testament books of history, when we started that with the book of Joshua, that predates, I think nowadays we kind of date a lot of things about before and after COVID, but anyway, we were way ahead of that, which means we've been at this for some years. So I mean, we had to cover all that is in the scriptures that we could look at about the period of the judges. And then, of course, after that, all of this Bible history that we have about the this period of time when Israel had the kings. We're almost at the end of that. So the period of judges, that was 450 years, and we know that the period of the kings was over 500 years that we've looked at. So if you're thinking, well, this sure has been a while that we've been studying all these books, I mean, that's about 1,000 years of Israel's history that we've been going over through this time. So I'm going to offer that as my justification for being so slow going through this. But as we know, there's a lot of books here, and we've been through Joshua and Judges and First and Second Samuel and First Kings and First Chronicles, and almost now finished with Second Kings and Second Chronicles. We've got a few verses left in Second Kings chapter 23, and then that brings us to only two chapters to go in the book of Second Kings. And we're already at the place to, in our study, that would be the correspond to the beginning of the 36th and final chapter of the book of Second Chronicles. So we are almost done with that study of all of the kings of, well, the first three, Saul and David and Solomon, which were the only three that reigned over all 12 tribes of Israel. And then after the division, the split in the kingdom, following Solomon's death, and the 19 kings that ruled over the 10 tribes that were given first to Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. And we saw all of that happened with that kingdom, and all 19 of those kings being wicked, as we know that that Jeroboam immediately turned his kingdom away from the Lord and established an entirely new religion for his kingdom. And they never departed from that, which is why Jeroboam is, we read his name, I mean, his full biblical name seems to be Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin. But almost every reference to him, certainly after his period of time where he was reigning, that's how his name appears in the scriptures. Because all the rest of the kings, it tells us how they did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin. And we saw that statement over and over again, which led to the early demise or destruction of that kingdom in comparison to Judah. It was in Hezekiah, the days of Hezekiah, king of Judah, where that northern kingdom fell to the Assyrians when they besieged Samaria, the capital, and then conquered it. And the remnant of those tribes in the north, although we saw that Hezekiah made that final effort that God provided as an opportunity for the remaining ones of the tribes of Israel, of that northern kingdom, to repent, and there were a few that did, and that responded to Hezekiah's invitation to all of them to come to that Passover feast that he held, and And there were some there right at the very end. The Lord was still working with them and trying to save every one of those souls right to the end. And there were a few that that were, and that they repented. And but the vast majority of what was left were carried away by the Assyrians into captivity, dispersed among the kingdoms that they had conquered, and that was the end of them, and never to return. And so Judah's been left on her own after that. Now with the with King Hezekiah, the king that was reigning over Judah at the time the northern kingdom fell, he was a very righteous king and had the people of Judah turn them back to the Lord, and they followed the Lord all of his days as he did. And the Lord delivered them from the Assyrians during his time. And so that was one of the great and few high points or good points in the history of the kingdom of Judah, because the only righteous kings they had of their 19 kings were Asa and Jehoshaphat, a father and son. And then we had that long gap, and then had Hezekiah. Yeah, there were a few that served the Lord in the earlier part of their time. Brother Miles brought out the example of one of those the other night in the study at Caleb and Kara's house on Friday night. That example of Ahaziah, who did serve the Lord. He was one of those ones who served the Lord and was blessed and strengthened, but then he turned away from the Lord after that. He's the one that entered into the temple to try to make an offering on the altar that only the Lord's priests were authorized to do, and he was struck with leprosy. He was the he was the third king in a row from that point, beginning with Joash, and then Amaziah, and then Ahaziah, who was Uzziah, and then his son Jotham. We had four in a row that followed the Lord for a period of time, but then they departed from him. So they would they be counted by God as being righteous? No. Are they going to be rewarded for any of the good they did when they followed the Lord in their younger years? Or are they going to be punished for the wickedness that they turned to and died in? And we took the opportunity as we were studying that section of the kings of Judah, looking at Ezekiel chapter 18, and we saw how the Lord, how he judges. A man that was following wickedness and turns to righteousness. Is the Lord going to mention his sins against him when he's repented and forsaken those sins and then serves the Lord? Or is he going to be judged in his righteousness by the Lord? Well, that's a yes there. But by the same token, those who turn away from the Lord from righteousness to wickedness, their righteousness is not going to be mentioned to their credit in the judgment. In fact, it's going to be worse if for those who knew the Lord's will and then turned away from it. That judgment is going to be even more severe. So we only had Asa, Jehoshaphat, and then Hezekiah up to that point when the northern kingdom of Israel fell that were righteous, that the Lord describes them as having walked in the ways of David all of their days and didn't turn from that. But then after Hezekiah, his own son Manasseh became the most wicked king that Judah had ever had, which was quite an achievement considering Hezekiah's father Ahaz and how wicked he was. Yet Manasseh went even deeper into wickedness and caused all the people of Judah to fall into such a degree of wickedness, especially in offering their children in the fire to the idols that they were worshiping. The Lord said he would not pardon those iniquities, especially that innocent blood that they had filled Jerusalem with. And so the Lord pronounced destruction on them. Now, it's quite interesting that the Lord still worked with Manasseh himself and actually brought him to repentance late in his life. But his son Amon did not, and had a brief reign of 2 years. Then we had Josiah, and that's the king which was the The last of the righteous kings of Judah, the fourth and final of the righteous kings that Judah had, was one that God described as having like him was, that was in 2 Kings 23, 25, where the Lord said there was like unto him no king before him that turned to the Lord with all his heart and with all his soul and with all his might according to all the law of Moses, neither after him arose any like him. And we saw last week, we finished up with the seeing how the Lord brought the end to Josiah's life. The Lord chose the timing of that. Josiah was still a relatively young man at the time. But the Lord had, and it was, we also saw that it was, he was the same age when he died that Hezekiah had been when the Lord had stricken him with that sickness when he was planning to take Hezekiah. But then the Lord gave Hezekiah that additional 15 years of life when he pled to the Lord for that. The Lord was quite able to finish his work in the heart of Hezekiah and in Josiah within that period of time. But he chose to take Josiah at that time and did not give him additional years. We don't have, of course, he was not given a sickness like Hezekiah was. What was one of the reasons that we considered the Lord may have chosen the means that he did for Josiah's death, and what was the way in which he died? He was slain by the Egyptians, Pharaoh Necho, that was on his way up from Egypt to meet the Assyrians. And so that brought him directly in by his pathway of travel. I mean, if you're going from Egypt to Assyria, you're going to pass through which region? You're going to pass through that region where Palestine is, Israel. That brought Necho into proximity to Josiah, how did Josiah regard the Egyptians coming up through his territory? Well, he did not appreciate that, so he went out to meet him. Necho, the Pharaoh, told him that he wasn't coming to against Josiah, and that God had given him that purpose to go meet the king of Assyria. And so he warned Josiah, but it's quite obvious that Josiah did not believe Necho's word. But he went out and met him, and then he was slain. We then asked the question, and we don't have any explicit statement where God said, he did that, he chose that way to bring Josiah's life to an end because, and then give us the exact reason. But we can look at statements that the Lord did make about all the different circumstances and things that were going on at the time. And at least it can give us some thought concerning what some of the reasons may have been. We're not going to say anything definitive, but we do know this, that we can be definitive about, what was going on with Josiah was not just in isolation, what God was doing with that one individual. That's the truth at all times. I mean, God is working in the heart of every individual that he made and has made in this world. That's true at any time and at all times. But as he's also working in the heart of each individual, he's working in the hearts of all the other individuals and with nations and kingdoms. When God is making a decision about one soul, when he's going to take them, is that ever in isolation, or is that one part of God's work that is in the context of all that God is doing in ruling this universe? And whatever he decides to do with any one of us, is God going to have consideration for others? And our leaving here, it should have an impact on others. We see that in Philippians 1 with the Apostle Paul. Paul was ready to depart and be with the Lord. But what did he say was a reason that the Lord had Paul still on the earth? He said, for me to remain is more needful for you. So for God to take Paul, was that going to have an effect on other brethren? And would that be a consideration in the mind of God as to when he was going to take Paul as that example? Well, certainly. We know that. We have a statement about that. Well, here was Josiah. What was the big work God was about to do with his people that we're about to see coming up right in the next part of our study? What's the big work that's about to happen that God's going to do regarding his people? Yes, they are about to face that outpouring of the wrath of God and his judgment for all of this wickedness. Now, God had determined that. He had spoken that. We saw when he had made pronouncements of that judgment in Manasseh's day through the prophets that he sent when that was happening in his time. Well, here then Josiah came along. They found the law of the Lord in the temple when he had commissioned the cleansing of the temple. That was brought before Josiah, and he heard all of God's words in his law, but also, of course, that included all the curses, the warnings that God gave when he gave the laws to what would happen to them if they forsook him and disobeyed him, including all of those words where God told him how he was going to destroy them, send them off into captivity. And Josiah became aware of the details of all of that, tore his clothes, and then sought to hear from the Lord, and he gave answer through Huldah the prophetess, and God said he was going to do those things against his people, was not going to pardon all that. But then what did he say because of Josiah, his humility that he showed before the Lord? Not in his time, but it's coming. So God reserved the pouring out of that wrath and the bringing forth of that judgment for the time that Josiah was on the earth. So that being the case, could there be a reason why God was not going to extend Josiah's life many more decades? So he was able to accomplish the work and form the heart of Josiah, and it was going to then fit. He had that work to do in the individual Josiah, but then he also had that work to do with his people Israel. And so whatever he was doing with Josiah, and then when he decided to take him, was going to have to fit in with the timing of God's judgment on his people. So there were a lot of those matters that were there and in the mind of God that determined when he took Josiah, how he did so. There's going to this Necho, the Pharaoh, we're going to see the very next thing, Lord willing, in our study. He's going to be involved in what happens to the one that succeeded Josiah on Judah's throne, who was Jehoahaz. And he's going to have a 3-month reign, and the same Pharaoh, Necho, is going to remove him from the throne and carry him into Egypt, and he's going to die there. So whatever happened with this Pharaoh regarding Josiah was going to affect what he did with his son. Of course, all being God's work. So God's doing a lot of things. I mean, how many things is God doing at once at any given moment? I mean, we can't even conceive of it. I mean, we can maybe consider several things that he might be doing at the same time. But I mean, God is doing all of this work in the hearts of 7+ billion individuals while he's also doing all of his work with the nations, all of that. And how many different things is that going to have God to consider in determining his plans and what he's going to do when? And with, I mean, it's we really are incapable of comprehending all of that, but we do have some clues and statements from the Lord, at least, that tells us the kinds of things that what God is doing, the works that he's doing, and how he's going to be making all of these things fit into whatever his will is. And so that was the case with Josiah. So Josiah died. His death was recorded there in 2 Kings chapter 23 down through verse 37, and then through the end of 2 Chronicles chapter 35. So now in our study, that brings us to Josiah, his not just successor, but his successors, plural. And they're going to come in relatively rapid succession. As I just mentioned, Jehoahaz, Josiah's first son, is going to have a whopping 3 months to reign as king of Judah. So, I mean, three months, there's less than 100 days, and he's out. And then his brother, Jehoiakim, is going to become king. Now, he's going to reign for several years, and then he's going to have his son to take the throne, who's going to have a reign as brief as Jehoahaz's was. And then we'll have Zedekiah, which is the final one. So we have four kings that we're going to have packed into really just a few years, 25 years or less of time. So there are going to be four here on that reign over Judah, the final of those four kings that they had. Now, the interesting part of that is right after Josiah, as we would expect, his son becomes king. Well, he's going to be removed, so then the second son of Josiah becomes king. And then his son, which is Josiah's grandson, becomes king after him, but he's still young, removed from the throne. And so then another son of Josiah becomes the final king of Judah. That's Zedekiah. So it's after Josiah, it will be son, son, grandson, son of Josiah. So we're going to have, the last king of Judah is another son of Josiah. So we're not going to get past, other than the brief reign of one of his grandsons, the next to last king. I mean, we're not going to get past a generation from Josiah before we see the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple, and only a remnant of the children of Judah, that basket of good figs, as they are described in Jeremiah 24, that's just a remnant that was taken into captivity in Babylon and preserved there. And then after 70 years of captivity, we'll see the captives return. And that's going to be the last major section of our study, from the judges, the kings, and then we have the captivity, and then that post-exile period of Israel's history. And again, when we use the word history, with what we're studying from the Bible, we don't look at this like secular history, as men write their books of history, that, okay, here's what happened here, and this person did that. Well, that's the way it used to be written. I don't think that people write it that way anymore. We don't have just facts from witnesses. It doesn't seem like that's the way anything is done anymore. It's the way it used to be done, the way it should be done. But anyway, that's what we typically think of or should as recorded history, events that we have witnesses to, evidence for. Here are the ones that did this and that at this time or that time. Of course, in the Bible, that's not, we're not given this information that's just letting us know what happened. All of this ties into, is given to us by God himself so that we can know him, so that we can know our God and his judgments, his ways, and then have all the examples, the good ones that are that great cloud of witnesses, to learn from their good examples, to follow in their faith and obedience to God so that we can run our race to be like Christ. All the examples of unbelief, what not to do, as we learned then about the methods of our adversary, the devil. So all of this is from that standpoint. So spiritually, we can know what we need to know from our Creator. And so a lot of that's going to be there with what we see from these last kings over Judah. Sadly, from the standpoint of Judah in its in this time, there's not going to be any more righteous ones after Josiah. They're all going to be wicked. So it was very encouraging to see that faith and obedience of Josiah, just as whenever we do have some of those good examples to study from. That's very different than when we're reading about the wickedness of the rebels and have to see what their deeds were. And it's all necessary, it's a lot more enjoyable to study about the ones that are good examples. We need to have joy also in learning what not to do and being able to know the methods of our adversary so that we don't fall prey to those temptations. So learning what to recognize and resist and overcome as far as temptation, that's something to be joyful about too in our study. So we have that to look at with those sons of Josiah. But let's go now to 1 Chronicles chapter 3. When we're looking at at Josiah's posterity, his descendants, well, we have recorded as in the Chronicles, as these early chapters of 1 Chronicles give a lot of detail of the genealogies of the tribes of Israel. But when we're in 1 Chronicles chapter 3, he starts in verse 1 saying, "Now these were the sons of David." So now we have the opportunity to be able to trace the royal line. We also get to see Josiah in this section. But as we start in 1 Chronicles chapter 3, verse 1, it says, "Now these were the sons of David which were born unto him in Hebron. The firstborn, Amnon of Ahinoam, the Jezreelitess. The second, Daniel of Abigail, the Carmelitess. The third, Absalom, the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur. The fourth, Adonijah, the son of Haggith. The fifth, Shephatiah of Abital. The sixth, Ithream by Eglah, his wife. These six were born unto him in Hebron. And there he reigned 7 years and 6 months. And in Jerusalem he reigned 33 years. All right, so the Chronicles, split up the descendants of David, his sons, divided between what was the ones born to him while he reigned in Hebron. Why did he reign in Hebron for 7.5 years and then 33 years in Jerusalem? Why was David's reign divided up like that? Yeah, the problem was that, Hebron was of which tribe? A city of which tribe? Judah, which was David's tribe. The problem here was the recognition on the part of God's people of the decision that God had made concerning who their king was. Now, how many times was David anointed king of Israel? Three times. Three different times. The first one, in 1 Samuel 16, was by Samuel the prophet, who who directed him, commanded him to go and anoint a new king of Israel at that time? It was God. So, of course, what was in the chapter before that? 1 Samuel 15. And whenever there's some of those chapters when you just hear the number, we should associate that with certain events. I mean, if you hear 1 Samuel 17, what's that chapter about? This is good for the kids to know. So 1 Samuel 17, that's David and Goliath. That should be one. I mean, 1 Samuel 17, I mean, if you ever want to find about David and Goliath, just 1 Samuel 17. All right, well, 1 Samuel 15, just two chapters before that, that's the chapter about, when Saul didn't obey the Lord concerning the destruction of the Amalekites. And it was at that time in 1 Samuel 15 when he did not obey the voice of the Lord that God made the decision, and Samuel said, "This day the Lord has rejected you from being king over his people Israel." So when did, two chapters before that, in 1 Samuel 13, that's when Saul disobeyed the Lord, when we're getting a lot of opportunities to tie things into, Brother Miles was teaching a lesson Friday night, I think most of us were there, but remember when he was teaching about we are priests of the Lord in Christ in the New Testament. I mean, we are the spiritual children of Levi, as he describes us in Malachi chapter 3. That's who we are. Spiritually, we are the children of Levi. We're spiritual priests. But we learn a lot about our duties and the principles of the priesthood from the shadow of it, which were the Levitical or the Aaronic priesthood of the Old Testament. And then when we see things that God authorized for the priest to do when anyone else was doing those things, such as King Azariah, Uzziah, when he went into the temple, being of the tribe of Judah, was he authorized to go into the temple and to go into the holy place and make offering there? No. Only the priests were authorized to do that. Not even all the Levites. I mean, only the priests, the sons of Aaron, could do that. Only the high priest once a year could go into the most holy place on the Day of Atonement. So there were very specific things that God authorized. What was the third object that was put into the Ark of the Covenant? What was the first one? The Ten Commandments, those tables of stone. What was the second? A pot of manna. And then what was the third object put into the Ark of the Covenant? Yeah, Aaron's rod that budded. Why did God have that put in the Ark? It was, what happened right before that? That's Numbers 17, where the rod of Aaron budded and bore almonds. But what happened in the chapter before that, number 16, that was the rebellion of Korah, who was a Levite. But what did he say to Moses and to Aaron? You take too much on yourselves. He was envious. God had chosen Moses to be the judge of Israel. I mean, that was God's decision. And he chose Aaron to be the high priest. Well, here was Korah of the same tribe as Aaron, and of course his brother Moses, but he wasn't the judge. He wasn't the lawgiver. He wasn't the high priest. And he was envious. And so he was accusing them of having taken that on their own authority. And so he was challenging that. And on his own authority, he was declaring himself to be able to do whatever they were. God made a new thing in number 16. Especially for Korah and his company. What was the new thing? The earth opening her mouth and swallowing them up. So if they died the common death, then the Lord hadn't chosen Moses and Aaron for their positions. But if the Lord made a new thing, then that was going to show that they had God's authority, which Korah did not. And God bore witness there, didn't he? So Korah got swallowed up, but then he made all the tribes put the names of their tribe on a rod. And but for the tribe of Levi, what was put on that rod? Just Levi? Aaron. So not the whole tribe, but the man who was the high priest. So it would just be Aaron and his descendants. And the one the rod that budded, God was saying, that's the one I've authorized to be priest. So anybody else from Korah, that's what that whole example was about. Anybody else that was taking that authority on themselves was going to be in conflict with God. And so King Uzziah was. Have some other examples of ones who did that. 1 Samuel 13, just to kind of complete our circle here. What did Saul do in 1 Samuel 13? While he was waiting on Samuel and he was losing his soldiers and all the people as they were afraid of the Philistines that were gathered there at Michmash against him. And instead of waiting on the Lord through Samuel, Saul was losing the people, and there was nothing that Saul cared more for than the favor and loyalty of the people, where they would follow him. So when he was losing the people, what did he do? He usurped authority and made a sacrifice himself, he being a Benjamite. Did he have authority to do that? He did not. So that's when the Lord said that he was not going to allow the kingdom to continue with Saul's descendants. He didn't say in 1 Samuel 13 that this day I've rejected you from being king, but he made it clear at that time that after Saul's time was up as king, that was going to be the end of the... He was going to be a one-man dynasty. Of course, there's no such thing. That's a contradiction in terms, but he was not... There was not going to be a house of Saul to reign. God was going to take the kingdom from him, and he was going to give it to a man after his own heart, which was David, who was of the tribe of Judah. So it was going to transition from one house to another, not just that, but would be from one tribe to another. Now all that fit in with what God had determined he was going to do concerning who would be the royal tribe in Israel. So did God know who he had chosen with Saul? Was he going to choose the first king, a man after his own heart, that would then cause that kingdom to persist of that tribe from Benjamin? No. So the Lord knew what he was doing in all of that, of course, and so he chose Saul. But he was going to fulfill his plans that Judah be the royal tribe. And that was David. It was when Saul rebelled in 1 Samuel 15 that God, having already said after Saul there was going to be a new king, it was going to be David. But in 1 Samuel 15, what did God say then? This day he rejected him. So he chose David to be the next king of Israel, but that was starting then. So the immediate action he took at that time when the Lord said through Samuel that he had rejected Saul from that day, God chose a new king right then and there, sent Samuel to anoint David. And then what did he do right there at that time? What did he give David and take away from Saul? Yes, and what did that signify? Who was, in God's sight, who was now king of Israel? David. And so when David was running from Saul and telling the high priest, I'm here on the king's business, was he lying? He wasn't there on Saul's business. He was there on his own business, but who was the king? So he was there on the king's business, all right, but as God recognized it. So that was the first anointing of David as king. Now, which one counts? That one. That's when David really became king. But the people didn't accept that. And of course, the word spread. It wasn't like that. It was a secret. Saul knew, and Jonathan, Abigail. I mean, you can read several different cases. I mean, it was acknowledged by Abner. What God had determined was something that became known to all in Israel, But the people didn't accept that, not even his own tribe out of fear for Saul, but finally when Saul died, so we had all that period of time after David was anointed king by God, where he's running for his life from Saul until Saul finally died. And then and only then was David accepted as king over Judah. And that's when he got his second anointing as king by Judah, his own tribe, and he reigned in Hebron. But it took 7.5 years of civil war before finally the house of Saul was defeated. Abner turned to David and worked to have all the elders of Israel to accept David as being king. And then his third anointing was king over all Israel, over all the tribes. That's when he then conquered Jerusalem and made that the city of David. So that's why there was a division between David ruling in Hebron for 7.5 years and then Jerusalem. And so he had sons born to him while he was king of Israel, but only accepted by his tribe Judah, and then the ones born to him thereafter. Now, interestingly, of those ones we just read in 1 Chronicles 3 and verse 1, we know about Amnon. What is he infamous for? These sons of David, whose names start with A, they've all got some notoriety, some infamy attached to them. Amnon, yeah, he raped his sister Tamar, and then was murdered by his half brother, who was the full brother of Tamar, and that was Absalom, who was his third born, and then Absalom himself did what later? Rebelled against David to make himself king. And, of course, he was defeated. And then Joab, against David's commandment, killed Absalom. Then we read about his fourthborn, Adonijah. What did he do? He tried to take the kingdom, too, when Solomon was chosen by the Lord to be David's successor. And so Adonijah led a rebellion then. That all fit in with God's punishment for David with the sins of regarding Bathsheba and Uriah, that the sword was not going to depart from his house. So there was division in his family, and all those sons whose names started with A that were born to him there in Hebron were all part of that. Now we have, in the midst of that, the second born that we don't read anything else about other than his name and who his mother was. And certainly nothing bad recorded there about his second born son, this Daniel of Abigail. That'd be quite a shock to me if we read about a son of David and Abigail, that woman of great understanding, that there would be a son of theirs that was going to be doing the things that some of those other ones did. We don't know anything else about him. So we don't know whether he lived and he just quietly served the Lord and didn't get involved in those things. Although it seems kind of hard to see how he wouldn't have been a target for some of those wicked brothers that he had. But did he perhaps die younger in his days? We don't know the answer to that, but we do know that he's not spoken of being involved in any of the wickedness that those other brothers were. So anyway, those are the ones born to him in Hebron, those six. Verse 5 says, "And these were born unto him in Jerusalem, Shimei and Shobab and Nathan and Solomon, four of Bathsheba, the daughter of Amiel." Now it's kind of interesting. We read Solomon there, of course, but there's one a son that he had born there, Nathan. We don't have details about a lot of those. Why would David have a son named Nathan? Yeah. Now, that's kind of interesting because, well, this was born of Bathsheba, so this would have obviously been after that matter involving Bathsheba where he took her. Who was the prophet the Lord sent to rebuke David for that? Now, how many people have a heart so humble that when they're rebuked by the Lord through a prophet, that they're going to end up naming one of their sons after that prophet? So, we have lots of little tidbits that we can maybe just not catcher, recognize a lot of different things that show the goodness in David. I believe that's one right there. But anyway, he says, verse 6, Ibhar also, and Elishama, and Eliphelet, and Nogah, and Nepheg, and Japhia, and Elishbarma, and Eliada, and Eliphelet, 9. These were all the sons of David beside the sons of the concubines, and Tamar their sister. And Solomon's son was Rehoboam, Abiah his son, Asa his son, and Jehoshaphat his son, Joram his son, Ahaziah his son, Joash his son, Amaziah his son, Azariah his son, Jotham his son, Ahaz his son, Hezekiah his son, Manasseh his son, Amon his son, Josiah his son. So we've just read the royal line. All the kings of Judah after Solomon, from Rehoboam down through Josiah that we've looked at. So then verse 15, here we have the sons of Josiah. And the sons of Josiah were, now this is interesting because we don't have with all those ones between Solomon and Josiah, they don't tell us, we don't have who all their sons were. But in this case, it's pertinent because there was more than one that reigned as a king. All the other ones just had one. But with Josiah, there's more than one. And so he says, and the sons of Josiah were the firstborn, Johanan, the second, Jehoiakim, the third, Zedekiah, the fourth, Shallum. Now, when the Lord presents it like that and gives us the names and the using the numbers, he's giving the order. Can there be any question about how many sons he had and which one was born first, second, third, and fourth? I mean, that is an explicit statement. There's no wiggle room. Anybody that comes along, because you'll see that. And in fact, if you read so-called historical accounts by the scholars on any of those things, you'll see they do all kinds of things, mixing up the names of Josiah's sons and totally reject and contradict what's right there in 1 Chronicles 3:15. Just another reason not to pay attention to those so-called scholars. But we need to get our information from God and listen to that and no other. But he gives the four sons of Josiah and their names. Now, Johanan, it's his firstborn. Now, when we read about him in 2 Chronicles chapter 23 and verse 30, when he becomes king, when Josiah dies, he's referred to by what name? Jehoahaz. So Johanan has to be Jehoahaz. The second is Jehoiakim. Now, he's Jehoiakim, we're going to read that. And there's a difference in some of the names. We're told in when Jehoiakim becomes king, his name was Eliakim, and it was Pharaoh Necho who put him on the throne and gave him the name Jehoiakim. Johanan and Jehoahaz, those are similar names, but Jehoiakim and Eliakim, and those are two names for the second son of Josiah. It would certainly look like Eliakim was the name given to him by Josiah, but he was given a regnal name by Pharaoh Necho, who put him on the throne. Of course, God did through him, but he was known as Jehoiakim and is called by that here in 1 Chronicles 3:15. The third son here is Zedekiah. Then we have the fourth, Shallum, and we're not going to know anything more about him because Zedekiah is the last king of Judah, so he didn't get a turn, Shallum, which is probably just as well for him. Now the sad part, of the three sons of Josiah that became king, Johanan, also known as Jehoahaz, Jehoiakim, and Zedekiah, those three were what kind of men? Every one of them are described as being evil. And they did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. So here we have one of the most righteous men in all the Bible, and we have three of his four sons that are described, that became kings and are described as being evil. Not one of them righteous. And how sad is that, that you have the one that we read about there that the Lord said none of the other kings followed, turned to the Lord with all of his heart, soul, and mind and strength to keep the law of Moses like Josiah did, yet not any of his children, not any of those sons that we read about there. Shalom is the only one that we don't read anything about. So we do have a statement about Josiah's children in a summary, and this will be the last little, we'll get into more detail of this, Lord willing, next week, but this last little peek here is before we close this morning in the book of Zedekiah. And we're trying to find information about the events at this time in Israel's history. It involves or requires more than just looking at what's in the end of 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles. A lot of the prophets overlap this time, which we can understand why, considering what was going on in Judah at the time with all of that evil taking place. Did God send hordes of prophets when they were all doing well to tell them what a great job they were doing? That's not the pattern. So when there's lots of prophets around at a certain time, that means things are not going well spiritually for God's people. But anyway, here's Zephaniah, and in chapter 1 and verse 8, the Lord's pronouncing the destruction that's coming. It says, it shall come to pass in the day of the Lord's sacrifice. And by the way, that's not good if you're part of the Lord's sacrifice. He says that I will punish the princes and the king's children and all such as are clothed with strange apparel. But what does he include among all those wicked ones by name there? The king's children. Which king? Josiah. So what is the Lord's summary of Josiah's children? All bad. And how sad is that? Was it his fault? I mean, he did everything he could to get all the people of the kingdom to follow the Lord. But what did we read about that? How successful was he in getting all the people to follow the Lord? He made them swear to the covenant. He gave them the example of doing so, read the words of God in their ears personally. And how much effort would he have taken with his own children? We know he would have taken great effort there. But what happened? The people didn't listen. His own children didn't listen. If anybody has the formula for how we can make somebody listen and believe, well, there isn't one. I mean, that we can't. We can only teach and encourage, but we all have to decide to do what's right in the Lord's sight. We'll continue with our study, Lord willing, next week. Let's bow in prayer.